let me tell you something. You don't have to worry about people who are poor attacking you for no reason. But if you take away people's privileges, if they have something and they lose it, then you better watch out. They're going to get violent. Some of my listeners, I hope, are committed anti-fascists, people who show up in public to fight the fash. Welcome, brothers and sisters. I, too, have counter-protested the KKK and other white supremacist groups. We deplatform them. We deny them a presence in the public square. This is all for the better. The German Social Democratic Party, the SDP, also did those things, and they were organized for fighting fascists on a much grander scale than we currently are. But what the German SDP failed to do was to block Hitler's ascent to power politically. Understanding this history is crucial if we're to understand how to work for political progress when the occupant of the White House is an open fascist. For the sake of brevity, I'm going to mention here the sources I draw on for my understanding of the German Revolution and just make the citations in the transcripts. These books are excellent. Pierre Bruet's The German Revolution, reprinted in 2005, a collection edited by Marius S. Dostrovsky called Edward Bernstein on the German Revolution, first available in English in 2019. Arthur Rosenberg's excellent 1936 History of the German Republic. He was writing a history of events that he had taken part in. And for general Prussian history, Christopher Clark's Iron Kingdom. I mean, do you ever think to yourself that Marxists would save themselves a world of error if they would just read a good history of Prussia? No, just me? Okay. Ferdinand LaSalle. That's a good place to start. LaSalle founded the General German Workers Association. This was the forerunner of the German SDP in 1863. LaSalle was a true believer in big government and in the Prussian bureaucracy, and in private, he courted Otto von Bismarck because LaSalle was convinced that Bismarck could be persuaded to provide universal suffrage. Now, Bismarck was an imperialist. This was not an unreasonable expectation of him, though, because the Prussian state had a long history of progressive reform. But a meaningful vote had proven elusive. In the Prussian Landtag, which was their Congress, the deputies were chosen by the vote of a College of Representatives. The College of Representatives was split into three equal parts, which were each elected by a different tax bracket. This meant that low-income people, the vast majority, could only ever get one-third of the vote in the College of Representatives, which elected their version of the House of Representatives. This meant that rich people's vote was heavily weighted. Moreover, Bismarck systematically abused the process to ensure the Landtag remained in conservative hands, favoring the interests of rural constituencies, that is, rent collectors. In such circumstances, a movement for radical democracy was necessarily a revolutionary movement. And this is why Marx uses the terms democracy and the dictatorship of the proletariat interchangeably. As we discussed, the dictatorship of the proletariat, as Marx understood it, was an armed force comprised of the working classes that would defend the gains of a democratic revolution. The failure and scandal of LaSalle's collusion with Bismarck, alongside the imperialist ideology of the middle German classes, led in Germany to a widespread discrediting of working in democratic coalitions and a kind of workers' chauvinism. I think LaSalle actually died in a duel, as stupid as that is. Marx and Engels did not realize that the German workers' movement they had inspired had lost faith in radical democracy. Arthur Rosenberg comments, quote, "The relation of the social democrats to the German middle classes and in general to all the other groups of the population who were not industrial workers was indeed very different from what Engels imagined. Engels believed that it would be possible to bridge the gap between the Socialist Party and the middle classes. Social democracy as the only actually progressive party of the nation might then be a real popular movement, capable of attracting ever-increasing groups without great effort. Actually, the rigid contrast of bourgeois and social democrat and the isolation of the socialist skilled workers which could not be removed even by the occasional entry of middle-class individuals into their ranks, already existed at that time. The old social democratic movement of 1848 had vanished from the political horizon of Europe. Its place was taken, even if very inadequately, by the various socialist parties and groups, unquote. As we saw last episode, in Russia in 1917, a network of democratic Soviets, which had begun in 1905, fought for power against the Tsar and won. In Germany, Soviets were not institutions that had similarly sprung up amongst the people because of a governmental vacuum spanning decades. The bulk of the German Soviets developed amongst the soldiers and sailors in Germany's armed forces, people who were not motivated by any ideology, but rather solely for the purpose of ending the war. The situation of German socialists at the end of World War I was very similar to that of the French revolutionaries of 1789, meaning they inherited the position of state power after the collapse of the former regime. The nation had a military that was organized partially into Soviets, but that was completely behind the government. We've spoken earlier about how the Prussian state provided a managed democracy where rich people's votes meant more. Underneath that official form of state power was a patchwork of compromises the Kaiser had made with the various regions that were brought under his rule. The cabinet that was tasked with leading the work of forming a government was composed of six socialists, three from each tendency. From Rosenberg, quote, Ebert, Scheidemann, and Landsberg represented the majority socialists, and Haas, Dittmann, and Barth the independent socialists. What kind of government would these socialists produce was the question of the day. Would they create a democratic republic, or would they create a Soviet-style socialist state based on the Russian model? So as you can tell, there was already at the end of the war a split between socialists who had voted for war bonds and supported the war, although perhaps what they meant by that was they supported Germany defending itself, but would oppose any kind of annexations. And the other side, those who had opposed the war from the beginning, that was the Independent Social Democratic Party, USDP. Now, the SDP more or less preferred a democratic republic that would respect the property of the big landowners. There is something to the idea that at this juncture, the SDP was following the LaSallian line of working within a democracy dominated by the bourgeoisie, with one major difference. The new German state was offering real equality of representation, while the Prussian state systematically worked to make sure poor people were not represented. The USDP held to what they imagined was the revolutionary aspect of Marxism, interpreted now through the lens of the recent Russian Revolution. But the context had changed radically, and the ideologues were largely unable to keep up. Under the rule of the Prussian Kaiser and Landtag, the only reasonable position for people who favored democracy was to be a revolutionary. Under the system where there was real democracy, one vote for each person, the Marxist position became ambiguous. One could imagine a democratic movement that would vote for progressive reforms and that would progressively move towards socialism. But the Marxist tradition did say the dictatorship of the proletariat, and so you can imagine how people got confused. It could mean that the working class had to be rallied to the defense of the democratic republic, or it could mean the time had come for the working class to abolish democracy. There was a vagueness within the original source Marxist text, and Marxists of the day had a real disagreement about what it meant. It all depended on whether you thought that socialism had to be democratic in the end, whether socialism had to respect the rights of people who differ from socialists, or if you thought it could be imposed from above. Within the German far left, those who were losing their patience with democratic reform were beginning to favor what they took to be Russian-style Soviet rule, the imposition of socialism from above by a minority of supposedly enlightened workers. As pointed out in previous episodes, Marx had expected a democratic movement to create republics where all people had a vote and had rights, and he advocated from 1848 onwards that when such a republic came about, that it would have to be defended by the dictatorship of the proletariat. The Russian experiment showed that if society were organized instead in democratic councils, that the state could, in theory, transition directly into socialism. In the attempt, the Russians ruined the democracy by driving the masses out of the government by an imposition of minoritarian rule under terrible circumstances, and they ended up with a totalitarian state where a ruling clique owned everything and everyone. The far-left fringe in Germany was trying to impose socialism from above without the democratic upswell that had vaulted the Bolsheviks into power to begin with in Russia. And the Germans failed very badly. Led by Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, they had to go to communities that didn't have Soviets and urge them to form Soviets. Despite the anti-democratic ideas then circulating in the USPD, these groups were invited to help form the new government. Over and over again, the SDP tried to bring Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht into the ruling coalition that was forming a government. For the most part, the socialists in Germany wanted to win over the rest of the population through education and reform. Even a large group among the Spartacists, who wanted to end private property, believed that existing institutions should not be attacked but discouraged through a process of education and legislation. On the far left, people believed that if workers were told the truth, they would choose to run production democratically, i.e., they would choose socialism. But there was a further left than that, a fringe that did not want to wait for society to catch up to their point of view. The German communists who split off from the German Social Democratic Party were the first to eschew democratic politics and try to take power as a minoritarian party in 1919. The lie that people told about Lenin, that he was an anti-democratic, that he was an authoritarian, all of those things are true of Karl Liebknecht. In 1920, when the Bolsheviks were at the peak of their power and prestige, radicals around the world were attempting to repeat the experience of the Russian Revolution, and mostly failing. As previously noted, Lenin's party rode a mass democratic movement into power, but in these other places like Germany, communists set up committees and attempted to seize power with or without a democratic mandate. Again, society must dominate the state. That's the definition of revolution. Though the Bolsheviks were desperate to spread the revolution to avoid the isolation that they ultimately fell into, they tried to convince the international movement to work within democratic parliaments where they existed and to address society at large, not just the workers' movement. The classic text of Bolshevik strategy that came out of these discussions is Lenin's Left-Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder. Lenin's argument hinges on the insistence that a small party, one that does not represent a large part of society, must realistically assess its reach and not attempt too much too soon. Quote, "One must not count in thousands, like the propagandist belonging to a small group that has not yet given leadership to the masses. We must ask ourselves, not only whether we have convinced the vanguard of the revolutionary class, but also whether the historically effective forces of all classes, positively all the classes in a given society without exception, are arrayed in such a way that the decisive battle is at hand." Unquote. In a situation where the party has been unable to lead society, unable to capture a plurality with its program, Lenin says that revolutionaries must support the liberal bourgeois candidates, that to not do so would be a crime against the proletariat. This orientation was informed by Lenin's experience organizing for socialism as a party that was outlawed by the Tsar. Without the right to free speech and assembly, which the political right wing were constantly threatening, socialists had no path to power. Lenin could change strategy in an instant. For instance, the slogan, "All power to the Soviets," that was his line in April of 1917, but that wasn't his line in March of 1917. It wasn't his line in December of 1917. But when it comes to the electoral strategy of the Revolutionary Party, Lenin is categorical. The Bolsheviks always, before 1920, participated in liberal parliaments, and never putting up candidates where doing so could spoil an election against the center-left. Overreaching, Lenin argues, means failing to even do what is within one's ability. Quote, "Science demands that account be taken of all the forces, groups, parties, classes, and masses operating in a given country, and also that the policy should not be determined only by the desires and views, by the degree of class consciousness and the militancy of one group or party alone. It is true that the Hendersons, the Kleinses, the McDonalds, and Snowdens are hopelessly reactionary. It is equally true that they want to assume power, though they would prefer a coalition with the bourgeoisie, that they want to, quote-unquote, rule along the old bourgeois lines, and that when they are in power, they will certainly behave like the Scheidemans and Noskis, Noski, whom Lenin blamed for the murders of Liebknecht and Luxembourg. All that is true, but it does not at all follow that to support them means treachery to the revolution. What does follow is that, in the interests of the revolution, working-class revolutionaries should give these gentlemen a certain amount of parliamentary support. The fact that most British workers still follow the lead of the British Kerenskys indicates that the British communists should participate in parliamentary action, that they should, from within parliament, help the masses of the workers see the results of a Henderson and Snowden government in practice, and that they should help the Hendersons and Snowdens defeat the united forces of Lloyd George and Churchill. To act otherwise would mean hampering the cause of the revolution, since revolution is impossible without a change in the views of the majority." Unquote. Germany was the first place where the strategy people thought had worked in Russia was applied somewhere else, and because it was exported without the democratic component, it failed. The resulting split in the German socialist movement, coupled with an anti-liberal politics, made Germany vulnerable just at the moment when a new ideological virus was spreading throughout Europe. That virus was fascism, the highest form of which was that of the German Nazi Party. But to understand how fascism arose and developed in Germany, we have to understand the splits in the Socialist Party, because it's out of that wound that the infection would spread. Karl Liebknecht played a key role in leading both the split in the socialist movement and the Spartacist uprising in 1919, and what's clear from his actions throughout this period is that he acted not out of concern for his fellows, nor to mobilize society for radical democracy, but out of guilt over his participation in World War I. Liebknecht, more than anyone in the movement, was committed to leading Germany into revolution by the Russian method, as he understood it, i.e., undemocratically. Regardless of whether the circumstances supported it, though he and his group, the Spartacists, were repeatedly invited to join in on the coalition forming the government, and the majority of Germany opposed the establishment of Soviet-style socialism, Karl Liebknecht led a boycott of the Republic. The agitations of Liebknecht led to a wave of protests in December 1918, with violence being committed on all sides. The Russians seem to have actively supported this agitation, seemingly oblivious to the different German conditions and the decline of democratic values in the movement, or maybe they were just desperate to break out of the economic and diplomatic isolation that the world had shoved them into. On the last day of 1918, the socialists who could not bear to wait and educate, those who abandoned democracy as such, founded the German Communist Party, the KPD. At this point, the USPD withdrew its support for the Republic. The insurrection on their left imperiled the democratic coalition that the SPD was trying to form. If they were going to stop Germany from devolving into civil war, they had to show that the rules would be applied fairly to all. The KPD would test by open insurrection the SDP's resolve to defend the republic. In Russia, the workers of St. Petersburg could rely on certain parts of the military from the very beginning, and Bolshevik influence in the Russian military expanded throughout this period. In Germany, on the other hand, the workers were being called to insurrection against a military that was firmly behind the republic. The departure of the USPD from the Republican coalition government had one important exception, Emil Eichhorn. He was the police chief in Berlin, and the SDP tried to replace him, but they failed. When protests broke out on January 4th in Berlin, they spiraled out of control, with the police chief being basically on the side of the protesters. Brouet correctly compares this episode to that of the July days in the Russian Revolution. In July, a mass protest movement took place in St. Petersburg that was not supported in the rest of the country. The Bolsheviks helped lead the protesters, who could not be persuaded against marching. Eventually, Trotsky was able to convince the protesters in St. Petersburg in July of 1917 to disperse. The army arrived a few hours later and would have massacred the protesters. The Russian movement in July was not ready to take power nationwide, and the Bolsheviks bided their time. Not so with the Berlin workers led by Liebknecht. Workers in Berlin, emboldened with the knowledge that the local police chief was in their pocket, became increasingly provocative. In fact, a large group of workers was allowed to occupy the police station and arm themselves, and the building had to be retaken by force of arms. Though the rest of the country was not behind the rebellion, they persisted. The SDP in power was facing, on one side, a sizable minority on their left that was intent on wrecking their project, and on the right were people eager to see the young democracy fail for their own purposes. Unable to call upon a police force, the socialists were forced to call upon the army to put down the rebellion. Now, the Prussian army was well known for its tendency to flaunt civilian control. Going back probably before 1809, there was a culture in the army of insubordination, particularly to civilian authority. But in 1809, Major von Schill defied the Kaiser and, together with Russia, attacked Napoleon's armies. Schill was afterward considered a national hero. Napoleon was so unpopular at that point that the Kaiser had to accept that because of the Major's initiative, Prussia was thereafter at war with France. In 1904, when there was an insurrection in the German colony of Namibia, General Trotha led a genocide against the locals over and against the protestations of the civilian authority in the person of the governor Theodor Leutwein. It's not clear that the Kaiser could really command the army against the will of its generals, and for sure the SDP couldn't. The Freikorps shock troops, who arrested Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, took it upon themselves to execute the beloved socialist leaders. The socialist who had ordered the army to put down the insurrection was Gustav Noske. Noske was a basket weaver from Brandenburg who had been made into the Minister of Military Affairs, and he was endlessly villainized for the deaths of Liebknecht and Luxemburg. Though no one could ever prove Noske explicitly ordered their deaths, it was always blamed on him. And according to this logic, opposing authoritarian socialists with state power when they don't have a democratic mandate and don't have any aspiration to radical democracy, opposing them still makes you a traitor. The entire movement of socialists in Germany for a democratic republic was from this moment forward considered to be, by the communists, enemies to the international communist movement. And it wasn't so. When the fascist parties rose up to attack the republic under the Social Democrats, they would find willing partners in the newly formed German Communist Party. We'll be right back. In the years that followed the Spartacus uprising, it was not the policies of the Weimar Republic that angered people, so much as it was the poverty of the government crippled implementation of many of these policies. There were guarantees made for workers' rights, but it didn't seem to matter much when unemployment was so high. Germany had to pay hard indemnities to the Allies because of its war guilt, which is still exaggerated to this day, German war guilt about World War I. They didn't make the same mistake after World War II. They had a Marshall Plan. And so even though people basically thought Germany was to blame for World War II, and yeah, clearly they were, they still got economic aid because people realized if you left a nation in poverty and punished them afterwards, eventually they were going to go rotten and rebel. And it must be said, the standard of living for regular Germans was severely impacted after World War I by the loss of its empire. Let me tell you something. You don't have to worry about people who are poor attacking you for no reason. But if you take away people's privileges, if they have something and they lose it, then you better watch out. They're going to get violent. Fascist was coined by Benito Mussolini. It comes from an Italian word that can mean a bundle of items or a group. Mussolini started his political career as a prominent part of the socialist movement in Italy. He was put in jail for 5 months in 1911 for participating in a demonstration against Italy's imperialist war in Libya. He translated two works of Kropotkin from Russian into Italian. He combined anarchistic libertarian ideology with a Nietzschean disdain for Judeo-Christian values and rejected the more traditional socialist values of democracy and equality. But as we have seen with the German KPD and the Stalinists, there were lots of socialists around this time that were rejecting democratic values. Mussolini's path from anarchism to fascism ran through Charles Maurras, George Sorrell, and the Cercle Proudhon. If you haven't read Alexander Reed Ross's Against the Fascist Creep, then what are you doing with your life? Go read it. But also, if you are interested in the intergenerational cross-pollination of fascism into and out of left politics, go read Alexander Reed Ross. If you just want to understand better the fascist movement internationally and as it exists in America, go and read Alexander Reed Ross. The important thing to understand about Mussolini in the context of the aftermath of the German Revolution is that Adolf Hitler got the inspiration for his National Socialist Party from Mussolini, right down to both of them embracing anarchism. Now, anarchism has a lot of different styles and flavors, and whenever I meet an anarchist, I don't pretend like I know anything at all about what they believe. I would rather they, on an individual basis, explain that to me, because there are so many differences. But what I have noticed is that in general, they tend to have a belief of the form, you should not be able to tell me what to do. And the content of that you and that me changes from one kind of anarchist to another. Okay, and so for your libertarians, the me there is just the individual. And you shouldn't be able to tell the individual what to do, no matter who you are, no matter what kind of state arrangement you have, right? For Kropotkin, the me that was to be supposed to be free from you, absolutely, is the communal village. So if you live in a communal village, you shouldn't have to suffer from a state power like the Tsar. That was Kropotkin's model, was the Russian village. For Mussolini and Hitler, the me that had to be free from any outside control was the ethnically defined nation. So what Hitler wanted, what his ultimate political goal was a nation without a state. And so what Hitler does after he gains power in 1933 is that he weaponizes the German state to destroy the states of Eastern Europe, to destroy the Czechoslovakian state, the Austrian state, and to launch the German army into a colonial war. And what he hoped would come out of that experience of colonially dominating Ukrainians and Belarusians and Russians and so on and so forth would be a rejuvenated German nation, and that the Germans would wake up to what the reality of the world was, which is the competition between races for scarce resources. Both Mussolini and Hitler had this vision of a nation without a state. They both hijacked state power in the project of reviving a sense of ethnic nationhood that involved race war over resources. And this is the core of fascist ideology. Any idea of solidarity across ethnicity, whether that be in socialism or in Christianity or whatever they believe, is just a lie that people told you to make you do things you wouldn't naturally do. Things like protect the rights of minorities or feed the hungry, even though they're a different race than you, etc., etc. But early fascist movements grow out of divided or defeated socialist movements, at least historically, as far as we can tell, and they adopt similar rhetoric. Hitler attacked the Jew as the origin of capitalism, but also as the origin of communism. Both of those ideas, he thought, were just people trying to fool you into cooperating with whatever they wanted you to do. Once fascists got into power, they never followed through with the socialist part of their program, but they did attack minorities. In the context of democratic socialism and revolutionary socialism both failing in Germany, you can imagine that German workers started to think that maybe international solidarity was a big con. And when they looked at Soviet Russia, there was plenty to be disappointed about. In 1919, a young up-and-comer, failed artist, and army veteran named Adolf Hitler joined one of the multiple ultra-right patriotic parties in Germany. He joined the party called the German Workers' Party. It seems Hitler was very charismatic, and after he took leadership of the party, he renamed it the German National Socialist Workers' Party. Alexander Reed Ross does an excellent job at summarizing the moment in 1919 when Hitler's party gets its big break. Quote, "The government attempted to dissolve the Freikorps, which responded to marching on Berlin. The push attempt was named after a civil servant named Wolfgang Kapp and was joined by Ludendorff, Erhard, and Waldemar Pabst, the men responsible for the killing of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. After the military refused to act against the push, the government fled Berlin and called a general strike, which led to the end of the coup attempt. However, the general strike turned into an armed uprising, and militant workers in the industrial Ruhr region formed a Red Army, putting the government there under worker control. Although they had refused to move against the Kapp putsch, the military joined the Freikorps against the Red Army of the Ruhr, killing and torturing hundreds of people. The leftists fought back bravely, declaring, quote, no atrocities, no revenge, no punishment, only love for humanity and justice, unquote. But the uprising of workers' and soldiers' councils ended in bloody oppression. Ensuing economic destabilization compelled the Weimar government to ask France for a delay in payment of war reparations, but Germany was instead met with a coordinated occupation of the Ruhr by the French and the Belgian armies in 1922. The Social Democrats and trade unions responded to the occupation with passive resistance, and the French authorities expelled 100,000 unionists and state officials along with their families. The Ruhr crisis and the ensuing political crisis with France created a political opportunity. Hitler seized on the model of Mussolini's fascism, its populist pageantry, and the showmanship demonstrated in that year's March on Rome. On the eve of November 8, 1923, Hitler proclaimed a national revolution at a crowded meeting in a beer hall in Munich. Leading General Ludendorff and other paramilitary members of the patriotic movement in an abortive putsch attempt on the government of Bavaria. Though the sardonically named beer hall putsch in Munich failed, his ensuing trial gave Hitler an important public platform to espouse his anti-Semitic beliefs. During his light jail sentence, he dictated his political manifesto, Mein Kampf, to his deputy Rudolf Hess, unquote. After the beer hall putsch, Hitler's career really takes off, not just in southern Germany, where his party originated from, but throughout Prussia as well. In fact, there's an interesting tension between Hitler's party and the Prussian elite, because Hitler's party and most of its membership originally are from Austria, and all the leading figures in Hitler's party are southern German or from some of these outlying districts that weren't really part of Prussia. And so while they adopted and co-opted some of the Prussian symbology, they never really uplifted old Prussian officers. So there's no real continuity between the leading figures of the German army and the Nazi hierarchy. That's sort of why the Nazis had to organize the Einsatzgruppen, because they couldn't trust the German army to follow through automatically with the fascist actions that they wanted to do in Eastern Europe. But the Einsatzgruppen was from the Nazi party originally, which is why they're chosen to deconstruct the Polish government and massacre the Polish intellectuals. Robert Paxton's Anatomy of Fascism gives us a concise survey of the typical way that a fascist movement develops. Typically, there's a period of grassroots mobilization. All across Europe, in the wake of the failed Russian-style coups, people saw the left as an authoritarian threat, and part of the impulse of fascism is resistance to that. But also, capitalism was failing working people who turned to national solidarity in the context of a collapse of international solidarity. In Italy and Germany, conservative governments faced with insurgent socialism from above. There was economic collapse and governmental dysfunction. They were faced with a choice about whether to partner with right-wing groups or not. In the 20s and 30s, fascists across Europe were reaching for state power, and in all but two instances, conservatives successfully resisted them. Conservative governments in Romania, France, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Croatia, Denmark, Holland, and Norway all rejected sharing power with fascists. In Italy in the 20s and in Germany in the 30s, conservatives who had lost any hope of ruling together with left centrists looked to the populist appeal of fascism to shore up their power. We see our own conservative movement split on this subject, with a small but important Never Trump movement campaigning openly for Joe Biden in a rejection of the far right. What role did socialists play in all this, for better or for worse? The best book I've found detailing the struggle against fascism by the German SDP is William Sheridan Allen's The Nazi Seizure of Power, The Experience of a Single German Town, 1922 to 1945. In this book, Sheridan Allen discusses how the fascist movement came to dominate German society by focusing on the experience of a small German town called Northeim in Lower Saxony. He shows us the shift this community makes through the 20s and 30s from a place where there is no Nazi party at all, and even a strong socialist party, to one where the Nazis are strong enough to put the socialists in camps. One of the more frightening things I noticed in this history is just how powerful the socialist movement was compared to our movement today. They held state power. Their membership included important community members. They ran electoral campaigns. They held rallies on a monthly basis. They organized sports leagues and choirs. They still couldn't keep Hitler out of power. Thank you. In general, the fact that the SDP sat in power during a time when the worldwide economy was tanking, it meant that people blamed them. Fascist governments somehow get more powerful the worse things get, because they can always blame someone else. Democrats, radical or moderate, are responsible for what they do in power. Anti-democrats, fascists, and Stalinists don't have to be particularly cunning to ruin the public's perception of a government when forces beyond that government's control, like a worldwide economic depression, cause the public pain. But the SDP did fail at certain things that they could have done, things that were within their control. Incidentally, legislating was not one of those things. The SDP instituted very important reforms in the economy that actually paid off after they were out of power. But that's basically how the economy always works. I don't know if you've noticed this, but the economy that a president has was caused by the president before him. I hope that everybody understands that, but I just want to throw that out there. Because of their cynical orientation to truth, the Nazis were able to change and craft their message to suit the audience. If the only reality in life is race war, then political ideas are just weapons that people use in war. The National Socialists could be all things to all people. They could represent themselves as champions of the workers against the bosses. They could paint themselves as champions of the nation's industry. But crucially, they communicated to Germans that they were both progressive and traditional. They had a radical program for change in a context where people were hurting. And they had a message of national greatness. And these were two things that the socialists did not have, right? The Socialist Democratic Party could say, we should support the government, we should support the way things are, which nobody was happy with. And they also were critical of the nation. And so they never communicated to the German people that Germany had great potential. And you know, I don't think we should try and win people over politically with that kind of rhetoric, with the rhetoric of America First, which is a racist slogan. It's the slogan of the American Fascist Party. And Make America Great Again is just another way of saying America First. But I very often wonder how the far left expected to gain wide popularity by consistently trashing America. It seems like we could easily communicate that America has great potential from a left perspective. We fail a serious hurdle leaving that emotion for the fascists. The Nazis could be incredibly popular with the middle class, who was losing their property. The SDP not only didn't work in government to protect the property of the middle classes, but kind of reveled in their immiseration. They made fun of people when they lost their businesses. Anyone who lost their livelihood could collect unemployment. They had a real robust social safety network. But people didn't want to be on the dole. They didn't want to be a burden. People want to contribute to their community and to be recognized as contributing something of value. And the Nazi Party gave people a way to connect with that feeling, with a sense of importance and a sense of self-worth in ways that the SDP could not. The Nazis put forward a rhetoric that blamed socialists for Germany losing World War I, which was easy for them to make a case for because the USDP had opposed the war. And so people talked about the socialists being backstabbers. And they said, Germany is great, but the reason why we lost the war was the socialists and the Jews. The rhetoric stuck because the SDP legitimately could not connect to people beyond a politics of class. They could not communicate to people a vision of national greatness that didn't center itself around racial chauvinism. It was ultimately a failure of the socialist movement to lead society as a whole that doomed the SDP and Germany. From Sheridan Allen, quote, to the socialists, the Nazis were a threat only insofar as they might attempt an armed coup d'etat. serious politics was a matter of rational appeals and positive results. Since the NSDAP, the Nazi Party, seemed incapable of either, they could not constitute a political threat. Nazi propaganda seemed to illustrate this, for it consistently pinned two labels on the SDP, Marxisten and Bonzen, approximately hard-wheelers or with overtones of corruption. The labels were, of course, contradictory. It is difficult to conceive of fervid radicals who are simultaneously comfortably venal. But effective propaganda need not be logical as long as it foments suspicion, contempt, or hatred. The choice of the two words not only had that effect upon the bourgeoisie, it summed up the dilemma of the Social Democrats precisely. The SDP was not Marxist, though it used language that made it appear so. Thus it was doubly encumbered, for it was unwilling to be a revolutionary party at a time when the best defense of democracy may have been social revolution, and secondly, its revolutionary tradition made it incapable of seeking or receiving the support of any but the working class. Furthermore, the SPD's defense of democracy meant, in practical terms, defense of a status quo which was identified in the minds of most Northheimers with national humiliation and economic ruin. Thus, the SDP could not keep the middle classes from flocking to the banners of the NSDAP, for the Nazis were known as real radicals. It was not enough to preach loyalty to the democracy or to the republic. Most Northheimers obviously felt no reason to respond to such an appeal. The way to undercut Nazis was not by blind opposition, but by a counter-program sufficiently attractive to awaken in the hearts of the bourgeoisie the kinds of hopes that the Nazis were able to arouse. Instead, the Social Democrats concentrated on holding the loyalty of the working class and saw the Nazi threat in terms of armed rebellion. Thus, no matter how hard they tried, Northheim's socialists did not provide effective opposition to the Nazis. Unquote. In other words, the German SDP wasn't trying to lead all of society. It had given up on radical democracy. And the parts that didn't correspond to their idea of agency, i.e. anyone who wasn't a socialist worker, slipped away from them into the ranks of the fascist opposition. The communists made the mistake of imagining their rivals, the Social Democrats, were worse than the fascists, or even called them the real fascists. This led them to working with the fascists at crucial junctures, leading to workers identifying with fascism and identifying fascism as progressive. In March of 1931, the communists joined forces with the fascists in a campaign to dissolve the Prussian parliament. In 1932, the KPD helped the Nazis in promoting and supporting a wildcat strike in Berlin. The communist orientation to a politics of class resentment led them to opposing social democracy when they should have been uniting with the SDP to fight fascism. The KPD had a political line that said the Social Democrats were the main enemy, that they were the roadblock to top-down socialist revolution, and that the Democratic Socialists were fascists on the left. The KPD thought somehow that if fascists took power, this would allow them to win a greater victory when the pendulum swung back the other way. But that is not how history turned out. That is not how things turned out ever. As it happened, the Nazi victory led to World War II and the Holocaust. The German people didn't so much react to Nazi governance with horror and a return movement to the left as they were exhausted by the war. To give you a more current example of the same kind of thinking, last year, Ece Temelkuren gave us an insightful book about how her country, Turkey, slid into authoritarianism. Miss Temelkuren is a veteran of the Gezi Park protest movement of 2013. Her book is entitled How to Lose a Country, The Seven Steps from Democracy to Dictatorship. I don't agree with everything she says, but it's worth the afternoon or so it takes to read the whole thing. She talks about this myth of a pendulum in regards to Slavoj Žižek, who endorsed Donald Trump in 2016. She talks about how, as fascism gains power, there really is no rock bottom from which one would have to turn upwards. Quote, during the 2015 elections in Turkey, our post-structuralist anarchist militant citizen and all those who theorized and believed that there is a political bottom to hit had to physically grapple with government supporters trying to put fake votes in the ballot box. They had thought that this was the lowest life could sink to until they experienced the referendum of 2017 on extending the government's powers following the failed coup. Once again, volunteering to monitor ballot boxes, they soon drew the depressing conclusion that election fraud was even more brazen than the previous time. Although volunteers meticulously monitored the voting process, when the counting began and it became clear that Erdogan could not win, the higher electoral board changed the election law from one hour to the next, following pressure from the leader himself, and egregious fake votes for Erdogan were deemed valid. The opposition came to understand that, with the authoritarian regime having seized state powers, even if there were to be a political reawakening, it was almost impossible to stop the political tide with their accustomed political behavior. They were hurtling down past the new political and moral bottom, unimaginable until it had actually happened. And as for our post-structural anarchist, like half the country who voted against Erdogan in the referendum that made him sole ruler of Turkey, he felt his latest blow would be the death of him. He was not to know that the afterlife would be even worse. The death of our particular anarchist wasn't at all accidental. It would have been foreseen much earlier had the progressive opinion leaders of the time not wasted years expecting a political metamorphosis to occur out of the total collapse of politics, and thus been quicker to inform the masses. Unquote. Robert O. Paxton's Anatomy gives us a concise survey of how the various fascist movements historically ended. Fascist movements who successfully entered state power then had to struggle against liberal institutions to maintain and expand that power. They had to overcome legal institutions and norms. By the end of 1932, political differences in Germany had become so polarized, the Nazi agitation so successful in generating a mass base, and the socialist movement so dysfunctional that the conservative von Papen government appointed Hitler as the chancellor in an attempt to establish some kind of order. There were daily protests in the streets, brawls between fascists and socialists. And I applaud Antifa, and I think we have to confront fascism in the streets. But we also have to recognize that the increasing public disturbances are going to give the government the excuse that they may want or that they may fear to impose this kind of strongman rule over us. In Germany, they saw the Nazi Party, these conservatives, saw the Nazi Party as a way for them to give the nation direction, and they thought they could use Hitler without him getting the upper hand. And this is precisely how Mitch McConnell has handled Donald Trump. In Hitler's case, the arson attack against the Reichstag building in February of 1933 allowed him to successfully persuade President Hindenburg to grant him special emergency powers. This began the final stage of the fascist movement, the stage that only the German movement was able to reach, deep radicalization. In this stage, Germany began the buildup of a war of conquest where they colonized Eastern Europe in the name of German racial supremacy and a war against Bolshevism. Hitler weaponized the German state against the state powers of Eastern Europe in the belief that in the resulting chaos, the German army occupying these other countries, that the German race would awaken to its historical task of dominating other races and eradicating world Jewry. The Trump administration has been struggling to tame the Justice Department and foil the Democratic Party's attempts to contain him. And this is part of why I think it was so important to attempt to impeach the president. And impeaching the president is a political act. It failed in the court of public opinion. But I have to say that the far-left press didn't do much to try and help people to imagine that the president should be impeached. In a second Trump term, the radicalization of this movement will combine with his increasing ability to flaunt the law. There is no world where Trump supporters of today turn on him in his second term. They have to believe his narrative about coronavirus or accept guilt for having imperiled or sacrificed the lives of their family members. The psychological pain and admitting guilt over Trump's crimes against humanity and democracy would be too great. So the false narrative must be believed, and greater crimes will be called for. This cycle of pain, corruption, and degradation continues in this way until Trump's enemies are all in camps, until America is ethnically cleansed, or until a cataclysmic war stops the fascist juggernaut. There is no rock bottom. When I first came to socialist politics, I imagined that fascism came about in Germany because the German Revolution had failed. If the Germans had had a real socialist revolution, then Hitler wouldn't have been able to come to power. But having studied the issue now for many years, it's closer to the truth to say that the German Revolution succeeded in achieving a democratic republic, but then undemocratic strains in the socialist movement sabotaged that republic, creating the opportunity for Hitler to take power. German communists adopted the false idea of Lenin having successfully imposed socialism from above. But if that were possible, they reasoned, then the real obstacle to socialism was democracy itself, which is absurd. The Spartacists and the KPD, then believing that down was up and up was down, worked to undermine the democratic government, believing falsely that a victory for the fascists would create a pendulum swing back to their side. They did not perceive that the fascist movement, once in power, could only be stopped by being pushed out of power by conservatives, or if it were allowed to radicalize by the conclusion of a long war between the fascists and bare humanity. They did not have the benefit of hindsight as we do. German socialists attempted what they thought was the Russian route to power, and the reaction to that top-down authoritarian socialism was an equally authoritarian right-wing movement. Communist abandonment of democratic values and open collaboration with fascists allowed Hitler to take power. And that's what I have to say about that. An almanac tells us what the climate is, when to plant, and when to reap. In this Democratic Socialist Almanac, I'm going to review the history of the socialist tradition in the light of the latest scholarship. I'll be talking about the good, the bad, and every one of us living in between. Once we've sorted out how we got here, we'll survey the paths now open to us and begin a discussion of where we want to go. Follow us on Facebook, support us on Patreon, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from.